And welcome back to Coast, Alan Greenfield with us. He's going to field some of your phone calls. A couple of his books include Secret Rituals of the Men in Black and also The Complete Secret Cipher of the UFO Knots. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Alan Greenfield with us. We'll get to your calls as well as we talk about Hellier, the occult. It's a remarkable program, and I guess it lived for another season, and they've put it, it's available for people to watch for free now, Alan.
Yeah, they the first season, I think, was free as well if you waited for it to appear on YouTube. It there was a delay and between the time it was on Amazon, but it was only like a two-week delay. These people are not in it for the money. They're in it because, like me, they love the work. Let me tell you one of the synchronicities that I'm talking about that are part of this, although only marginally discussed in Hellier 2, but I think it reflects what other people are now experiencing who've seen Hellier. Just the act of watching it is kind of a ritual. on two separate investigators associated with them. And if I garble the story slightly, it's because I'm trying to remember it, and I was not the first-person experiencer. But I believe it was Connor Randall who decided that a mysterious number, sequence of numbers that they received from this mystery person that they never found, was a latitude and longitude. I looked at it on a later date, and I said, "No, I think that's a like a UPS number or a tracking number." And indeed, it was a tracking number. But in any case, I believe it was Connor. He went to this location partly because it was very near Brown Mountain, the place famous for the lights, which I have investigated, and so have they. He was alone. He was out in the middle of the woods looking for the exact latitude and longitude. And what he found was a silver balloon that on one side said, "Happy Birthday." And he didn't think too much about that, but apparently it was significant because a black helicopter flew over. I mean, he was in the middle of nowhere. Black helicopter flew right over him, and he didn't exactly panic, but he was freaked out by it. But he had the presence of mind to take the happy birthday balloon. In the meantime, a different investigator in a different part of the country altogether was out in the middle of nowhere and saw this shiny thing floating down. This is, right at the same time, within 24 hours, I would say. And what it was a silver balloon with happy birthday on one side. Well, they told me this, while on camera in the during our interview, and I said, "You really need to pay attention to that. You're getting a birthday present. It's important that you realize that something that is that coincidental is a synchronicity, not a mere coincidence, if there is any such thing."
I don't believe in coincidences myself.
Neither do I, but a lot of people do, so yeah. I'm not going to call everything a synchronicity. I'm just going to say I think that these are synchronicities. Anyway, they seemed to go on by that and were more anxious to talk about something else. So at some point, I don't remember exactly when. I think it was after the formal interview, but they were still rolling their cameras. Very professional people. I said, "You really need to think more about the happy birthday thing, because that was a gift. And if you don't realize the importance of it, something will get in your path." So as I was saying before the break, after they left me, within a couple of hours, they're on their way to another little weird town in Kentucky, a long way from here, but they were driving. I give them enormous credit for the amount of miles they put on doing this work. And there's a tree across the road which stops them. And they get out. Greg gets out, looks at the tree, thinks about moving it, and then he notices a blue glow at the end of the tree that was, over at the top of the of the tree, goes over to it, and it's a blue star balloon. And we had been talking during the interview about Sirius, and that, which is a blue star, and the significance of Sirius being a blue star and therefore not likely to have been inhabited, at least not as a home base, because blue stars are relatively new. Our stars go from white to blue to red, to yellow to red, and then they self-destruct at some point. But point being that it's much newer than our star, although Sirius is has been tagged as a source for UFOs for a long time.
Right, the Dogon tribe, right?
Right. Well, the Sirius mystery that Robert Temple wrote, which is an extremely literate book about the Dogon and other tribes in the same area. Interestingly enough, I don't know what their status is right now because the Islamist jihad of that area basically disrupted life in that area, including Timbuktu. And you don't get any more remote than that. That used to be a synonym for remote, from here to Timbuktu. But be that as it may, I assume that they're still there and they still, talk about their visitors from Sirius, and they still have knowledge of the twin star, which you cannot see with the naked eye.
That's right. So which was bizarre because the Dogon tribe knew about it.
The Dogon and the Bambara tribe also has the same story. They're the next tribe over, and I think there may be a third group as well. They're not as well known, but the point is there's no possible way that they could have known about this unless it had been information from an ancient, very advanced civilization.
Passed
or indeed they were visited by beings who said they were from Sirius.
That's right.
My argument was that, well, Sirius couldn't be a source, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't be a base, So we had discussed that at some length, and so they got the balloon, and it was a blue star balloon, and they immediately thought of the conversation we'd had when I said, oh, something will be thrown in your path, and you should take the balloon seriously. And everybody in their car, it's not acting. They were really saying, Greenfield was driving us crazy with this balloon business. And what they didn't know at the time, they may not even know it now, but they'll know it now. My other publisher is Blue Star Press. And, there's no way
I'll
I could have set this up.
That's right.
I'm sitting here in the Jewish Tower, and I'm 73, and I ride my bicycle every day and consider that to be my exercise. There's no way
I
could
that's good exercise.
And knock down a tree and, plan a blue balloon. But the fact is that Blue Star Press published God Never Does the Same Thing Twice, which is my other current book, and that the other balloons basically were a message saying, this is a gift, you better take it seriously. So they are way down the rabbit hole. And everybody that I know that I've talked to about this is having synchronicity experiences comparable to that.
Constantly. Now,
and I'm thinking, I used to know an occultist, I still know her, I guess, named Amidali, dancer in England and a ceremonial magician and a Gnostic bishop, among various other things. And her deal is she does ritual as dance. And she says, and I've seen her do it, that people who watch her dance become part of the ritual that she's doing. Hard to explain, except that's the way it is. And if you experience it, you know that. That's for real. Similarly, the Hellier thing is a ritual, which I, have said to them, you are doing a ritual. And apparently this ritual is contagious because people that have watched it and been fascinated by it also have been having synchronicity experiences. And this is, I guess it would be a frustration originally, but back when I first discovered the cipher was applicable to UFO and paranormal events, I thought, wow, people will work with this and we'll have the one missing piece of the puzzle that the paranormal, at least in field research, has lacked, which is science insists that you have to have reproducibility. And of course, field research in anything, reproducing a situation, you know, if you want to reproduce the Normandy invasion on D-Day, you can't. You can reenact it, but you can't reproduce it because it's a one-time special event. And these are on a smaller scale, but some of them are pretty spooky. And I have, you know, I get calls from some of these people, and a few of them have, you know, sent me emails saying, wow, you'll never guess what happened. Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's all a matter of people who've taken not the red pill, but the green pill and gone down the rabbit hole. So I think that they are actively doing magic ritual, which is being guided by something or someone. And that's where it stands. It has had the byproduct that because it features the cipher and the interview with Terry and so forth, it also has, you know, catapulted my sales of my Complete Secret Cipher book to a height that I never dreamed that it would get. And the thing that I wanted the book to accomplish, I didn't care whether it made any money or not. Well, that's a lie. I cared, but that was not my primary concern. My primary concern was people will work with this and be able to predict paranormal events. They didn't, but after Hellyer, now people are doing
now
that
they,
and
now
getting results.
Yep.
It's just amazing.
Let's take a text or tweet from Tom, and then we'll take calls. Go ahead, Tom.
This one in from Corinne in Los Alamitos, California. Please ask Alan if he can discuss positive field research that suggests the authenticity of cryptids.
Interesting question, Alan.
Wow, that's not my specialty, but I think that there's a great deal of evidence that cryptids exist. The thing is, and I need to sort of explain my take on the entire cryptid phenomena, which is, like UFOs, they appear and they disappear. Sometimes, you know, there's a spate of them, and then they disappear. Same thing for Mothman, which I do know a good deal about. I think the Mothman cases in West Virginia in the 1960s, which I had a small part in investigating firsthand, and certainly supported John Keel and Gray Barker, who did the books on the subject, which I think nailed what went on then. All of the Mothman original cases are suggestive of something that appears, that's illogical, and disappears, but with... just when you think that it's gone and over with, it shows up again. And the common denominator often is if Mothman appears, something really horrible happens.
Bridges collapse, things like that.
Yes, there was a bridge collapse in Minnesota near, I believe it was in St. Paul, just a few years ago, which was one day after a man and his son had sighted a Mothman-type creature, reported it before the bridge disaster, and this was on an interstate highway bridge.
I remember that story.
Yeah, and then, more recently than that, there was a huge number of reports around Chicago of Mothman-type creatures bleeding over into, I think it was Indiana, into Indiana. And as recently as a week ago, people were still seeing Mothman and UFO cases sort of intertwined.
Jeez.
I think that when you have repetition like that, with sound people investigating it, the Chicago cases have been investigated by people that I know and trust, along with MUFON, which I think is a sincere group of people, not necessarily on top of any of the alternatives to nuts and bolts theories. That is, you know, the paranormal is not their line. When you have this same phenomena, something as unlikely as Mothman, recurring over and over, and each time, or almost each time, there is some sort of disaster in the works, some sort of objective disaster, not some, you know, woo-woo thing. Something objective happens, often involving bridges or planes or whatever. The most recent one, and I'm not trying to jinx anything, but was at Chicago O'Hare Airport, which is one of the busiest airports in the world. And I hope to God Almighty that, you know, nothing bad happens there. But it certainly is not a good harbinger. So, you know.
All right, back to the phones. Joe in Monterey, California. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yes, I have a few questions, but I've had some experiences practicing some of the Kabbalah techniques and, you know, creating a sword and pillars of light and stuff. Has anyone ever did a ritual? Oh, by the way, when you watch a ritual, you're creating it in your mind, and it's like the principle of as above, so below. So you're actually doing it like a sympathetic magic as well. Now, does anyone ever find themselves conjuring or doing a practice and a ritual of sorts, and they get something that they did not expect, and it wasn't very good?
Absolutely, and I caution intermediate students of magic and invocations or evocations, learn how to banish consummately before you even learn how to invoke or evoke, because things can get out of hand. Now, I'm about to, here's another synchronicity, sometime in the next day or two, I'm going to be posting on my Facebook page an account of I believe it was 1990 experiment with Enochian magic, where we were really spent 6 months going week by week with under controlled circumstances doing Enochian invocations. But we always did, I did the induction, and then I did firm banishings at the end. But there was always something weird happening during these things. It was a lot like classical physical phenomena, seances. And that's not what Enochian magic is supposed to be. But of course, if you're doing the 30 ethers and doing it correctly, you are going to get really weird results. The thing is, at the end of it, you'd best know how to banish politely, and you best know how to banish really well in case it's something that's persistent. And if it's really persistent or follows you home, as can happen in some of these workings, you need a good exorcist, which...
Alan, we're going to talk more about this and take final calls next on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about the Shroud of Turin, and then later on, Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us, talking about how to access our Akashic records. So make sure you're part of that Coast to Coast program. And welcome back. Alan Greenfield with us. George Norrie here. Alan, explain to us, of course, the UFO knots portion of this book.
Well, the euphonauts, which is... Our old hands in ufology use the term euphonauts, are the ostensible pilots of flying saucers or whatever these objects actually are. I think we see only a fraction of what is actually there. The cipher allows you to take a given close encounter case, a recent one, and by using the cipher against anything that shows up that seems significant, like an alien says, my name is Klaatu, you know, just to take something from fiction. Reducing it to cipher and then running it, the cipher value against various things, you can predict where the next close encounter case is going to occur. I don't just assert that. I say if you work with the secret cipher of the euphonauts, you are very likely to encounter euphonauts directly, whether you see them or whether you experience them, depending on how close you want to get. But that's what I have wanted to see happen since I discovered that the cipher was applicable to not just the occult, but to all kinds of paranormality, including UFO research. So that's where the euphonauts come in. Apparently, they generated the cipher. After all, it appears in a book that it is claimed was written by a preternatural being named Iwas.
Iwas?
Iwas.
Interesting. Karen, state of Washington. Go ahead, Care.
Hi.
Hi there.
I've just been listening to your show for a long time, and I'm so glad to get to speak to you finally.
Oh, great.
But when I was a child, my grandma came to stay with us. She was from Tennessee. She didn't believe in watching TV. She thought they were evil boxes, and she always read the Bible. And when she got to our house, I was reading scary stories. I was in middle school, and I think at the time I was reading Carrie. And she kept telling me, you know, you need to quit reading stuff like that. If you want to read something scary, you should read the book of Revelation. And I read it, and I didn't really absorb it. I think I was just too young. And I kept telling her, you know, if you take some of these words out, all these D's and I's, those, you can kind of understand it better. And at that time, like I said, it didn't really apply to anything, but as I got older, I would go back and read it. Especially once I got to where I was into science and we were learning, you know, that time I think they were trying to come up with jetpacks and things. And I told my mom, I said, if you go back and you read the Bible, a lot of the descriptions of when the angels come down and, you know, like there's a light in the sky that they can see even at daylight, it almost sounds like the UFOs. What if angels are aliens? What if that's the same thing?
You're very close to interpreting Genesis, to be sure, isn't she, Alan?
I think she's right on the money there. And the question is, are they aliens posing as angels, or are they angels posing as aliens? I leave that to people who have read my other book, God Never Does the Same Thing Twice, which I recommend. Oh, and there is a problem with the these and thous, which are also used in Liber Alba Legis, which is they're not in the original. I mean, if you can read Hebrew, particularly ancient Hebrew, which I can, or ancient Greek, which I can stumble through, very different. And that makes it a very different proposition from what you're reading in the King James Bible or even close revisions of that. But there are some better translations around now. But as I believe it was Robert Graves said once, all translation is a lie. A good translation is a polite lie, but all translations are lies.
Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Edward, go ahead.
Thank you, George.
Sure thing.
I have a question. You started off talking about with the cipher, you got into the Kabbalists as being kind of the top echelon or something like, you know, and Nostradamus, when he died, I guess you know the story, he had a bronze medal put around his neck with a ribbon, and it had the year, I think it was 1803 on the bronze medal, and he was buried in the wall of a church, and they were remodeling the church, and they decided, you know, let's take Nostradamus' coffin and let's open it, and they opened it, and he knew they were going to because that was the year they did it. And what I've heard is that He said he wanted to be buried in the wall of a church because he did not want the Kabbalists walking over his grave. And I have no idea what he meant, and I was hoping you might know.
I do not know. Alan, do you?
I'm not sure that that story isn't somewhat apocryphal, pun intended.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is, he was a Kabbalist, so maybe he didn't want rival Kabbalists walking across his grave, because he used Kabbalah. He was a Christian, but he had converted from Judaism, and Kabbalah was originally a Hebrew method of decoding scripture, and that was something that he used in developing his eerily correct quatrains. So it's possible, but I don't think that he had any kind of negative feeling towards Kabbalists. He was one himself.
Tom has another text or tweet for you. Alan, what do you have, Tommy?
This one from Jenny in Austin, Texas. Does Alan think the belief in the paranormal can damage some people, or is it dangerous in any way?
That's a really good question. My feeling is this. First of all, I never use the term belief in the modern sense of the term at all, where these things are concerned. I adhere to certain theoretical constructs unless something better comes along. And I believe that truth is something that is always in motion. We live in a universe that's defined by motion, and if motion ceased, the universe, as we know it anyway, would cease to exist. So I don't think that belief is the right approach. I think that approximation and using the test of common sense is a good idea. If somebody gets too deeply into a belief system, they become fixated, and there's one chance in five they're going to wind up in a cult. That's not occult, that's a cult, C-U-L-T. And you don't want to do that, because that tends to end badly one way or another.
It sure does. Next up, let's go to Josh in Winnipeg, Canada. Hey, Josh, go ahead.
Oh, hi there, George. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you.
Long-time listener. I was wondering, I was with a friend one day, and we were just walking by a park, and we saw two large beings, like, cloaked in black. And I was wondering, and they came right through, we saw a house window, right through the window. And just wondering if that could be something from the occult, because we both saw it.
Interesting.
They were occult figures.
Were they winged by any chance?
They weren't winged. They were just tall and hooded, and you got this terribly cold sensation came over us as well. We tried to draw them when we got back to his house, but didn't do a great job.
These entities, go ahead, Alan.
I'd like to see the drawing, but yeah, that sounds like something occult on that border between ghost lore and the occult. I think, taking into account the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, that we live in our three-dimensional universe thinking that that is the only universe that is. But actually, quantum physics suggests that there are other universes directly adjacent to our own. And more than occasionally, something slips through, not necessarily intentionally and not necessarily for very long. Hauntings are sort of permanent portals to somewhere else or something else. Something that's a one-time experience like that sounds like beings that flitted into existence and then flitted out of existence. Not that they don't exist on some other plane of existence, but that's what they are. If they stay for a while, get out your camera, get out your phone, and turn it on either a photo or film and film it, because that's the best way to deal with it. But these things happen spontaneously, and I know it's really hard. I've been in situations myself where I think, oh, well, if something happens, I'll use my camera. And all I do is say, look at that. Wow, look at that. And I've been doing this for 60 years, you know, so I don't fault anybody for not thinking of their camera when they're having what amounts to a spiritual experience.
Where can people get your books, Alan?
From all the usual sellers, Mr. Amazon, Mr. Barnes & Noble, from my publisher at Paranoia Press, and probably every other book distributor in the known universe.
And I have your Facebook link at coasttocoastam.com. Ready? Go ahead and spell it out.
My Facebook link?
Yep.
Oh, what I always tell people is I've been on the Internet since before it was the Internet. So if you just Google my name, A-L-L-E-N, Alan Greenfield, like it sounds, you will find tons and tons of stuff by me, about me, for me, against me.
You are everywhere, my friend, everywhere. Speaking of everywhere, here's a guy who was on his way into work. Had to leave a message for his boss. It's one of our classics.
Hey, Mark, excuse me. I'm on my way to 3768. Kind of got hung up. It's raining out here. I'm on my way into Dallas. Jerry's probably going to be calling you to find out where I'm at if he can't get a hold of me, I'm sure. So thought, whoa. Man, I just had a wreck right in front of me. This guy ran a red light and hit four old ladies in an Impala. Just kind of clipped him, turned him around right in front of me, man. That was close. Oh, now this guy's getting out of his car. He's got a white shirt on with a tie and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He's throwing his hands up in the air like it was their fault. Oh, hold on. He's going over their window. She's rolling down the window. Oh, man, I think she sprayed him with pepper spray, man. He's holding his face, and he's on his knee. She's beating him with an umbrella. The other women are getting out, too. There's one woman with a little black purse. She's tomahawking him, man. She looks like a Sunbelt 20 horsepower jackhammer. Blah, blah, blah. We got another woman she's hitting him like he's got a cattle prod, man. She's got an umbrella and she's sticking it in his side. Oh, there's another one. It's a little woman who looks like Mother Goose. She beat him. She's got this U-bit bag. She beat him. She's got this U-bit bag. It's huge. It's about the size of her. She's about 4 foot nothing. She hit him over the head. Everything went all over the place. Her Bible fell. She just hit him in the head with a Bible. She picked this Bible up and she lifted it way over her head. It was a hardback NVI version. Oh, they're still beating the out of this guy. She picked his Bible up and raised it up above her head and just beamed the guy. This guy's not getting up. They're still hitting him. The one with the little black purse is still, oh, pieces of it. okay, he's up on the car. the little woman just beamed him again with that big bag. He's running to his car. He's out of here. the little bitty Mother Goose one. She's talking to him as he's driving off. Oh, I wish you would have been here, man. This is too good.
One of the classics for Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Bedal, George Knapp, and Ian Punted. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.